Welcome to MoneyWeb at Midday, the actuality news show, offering unique insights and in-depth analysis featuring South Africa's top business leaders, newsmakers, and analysts for today's professionals. Your host, Jeremy Mads.
Hello and welcome to MoneyWeb at Midday. I'm Jeremy Mags with 30 minutes on South African and global news. We are live and then up as a podcast. Interviews with key business and political figures, prominent newsmakers and leading experts, all in a concise and informative update. It is Monday, the 22nd of July. Coming up on the program, counting the cost of political assassinations, the impact of Joe Biden's decision to step away as a candidate. Could we witness another global IT meltdown? Dealing with South Africa's massive visa backlog, and a cry for help today from the South African Local Government Association. A failed hit that injured SARS advocate Corath Nodir is the latest in a spate of such attacks, all aimed at subverting legal and criminal processes and often involving hundreds of millions of rand. News 24 reporter Kyle Cowan is working that story and joins me on the program now specifically about what events like this say about the rule of law in South Africa. Kyle, I'm very grateful that you're talking to us today. Obviously, we need to be worried. What does this attempted hit signify about the rule of law in South Africa and maybe the state of justice that we find in the country right now?
Good afternoon, Jeremy, and obviously thank you for having me. Yeah, I mean, I think the attempted assassination of a senior advocate who's working for the South African Revenue Service is a worrying escalation. You know, murder for hire assassinations in South Africa, unfortunately, are not new. It's not a new phenomenon. It's not something that has only started happening very recently. But what we are seeing is that people are, you know, disaffected persons are becoming more and more brazen in the types of people that they are targeting. You know, any person who sits and thinks about this for a second or two, an advocate is someone who can be briefed by anyone. Today, Advocate Nadia could be representing SARS. Tomorrow, you know, she could be representing you against SARS because of her tax expertise. And what we are seeing now is that once these legal processes, once, you know, the tax man really starts to try and, you know, implement the law, become very aggressive in how it goes after assets and, you know, how it uses the law to sort of bring, you know, tax miscreants to book, we're seeing a disproportionate violent response. And what we must understand about this, Jeremy, it's very, very important that we understand that this is not normal. Someone being shot at because they are leading evidence in a tax inquiry. This is something that is so far removed from what we would consider, you know, civilized, normal society, that we have to be shocked and outraged by this because it's one step away from, you know, a liquidator and his son being murdered in the middle of the day to an advocate being shot at, you know, in the middle of the day to senior political figures being targeted. And then criminals sort of just realizing that they can get away with these things sets a very, very dangerous precedent.
It does indeed. And also very difficult to suggest or recommend any type of action that should be taken to enhance the security of legal professionals and investigators who, as you say, are at high risk because of these targeted attacks.
Yeah, I mean, just logistically, if you think about it, on any given day, there are, you know, hundreds of these sort of tax inquiries or hearings or meetings going on between, and this is just SARS, we're not even talking about, you know, members of the Hawks or the SAPS or, you know, investigators working in the private sector, auditors, accountants, these sort of things. So logistically, you face a problem immediately straight off the bat. Who gets protection and who doesn't? The you know, a threat assessment, for example, if you or I receive a death threat, we report it to the police. A threat assessment then has to be done by someone from crime intelligence. Logistically, they don't have the manpower to be everywhere and do risk assessments on every single person who receives a death threat. So where do you draw the line? So where do you sort of start saying to people, okay, you know, you are obviously at high risk, you need protection, so let's organize that for you. And then where do you stop? You know, what about a teacher who is facing a domestically violent partner who is targeted as she arrives at work, or a nurse? And these are incidents that happened quite recently. You know, and we have to sort of start thinking about the fact that the deterrent for these types of acts is effective policing, solid prosecution, and those things, unfortunately, are not happening. And that is where I think we should focus all of our attention.
And obviously, if you are an advocate in a situation like this, you're going to think twice about taking a brief like this again. And that in itself has an impact on resolving important issues of malfeasance.
100%. You know, the chilling effect is very sudden and very, very strong. You know, already, you know, Advocate Nadia, they tried to murder her on Thursday afternoon. By Thursday night already, I was on the phone with colleagues of hers from the Pretoria Bar, speaking to advocates who were already saying, like, well, geez, we're going to have to review all our briefs and make sure that, you know, we're not putting ourselves in a situation where we could potentially face something similar. You know, and no case is worth this person. Is worth a person's life. You know, we have to accept that. And of course, this is the effect that people who perpetrate these kinds of crimes want. This is exactly what they want to happen. They want people to back off. They want people to be scared. And they want people to think twice. But we can't allow that. So we have to now somehow try and remind these criminals that these acts will see them facing swift justice. Unfortunately, so far, in numerous instances that News 24 has reported about, that has not happened.
And as far as she's concerned, and you'll correct me if I'm wrong, currently in a stable condition, but she has put her head into the tiger's mouth before, involved in several high-profile cases.
Yes, that's correct. You know, Advocate Nadia is one of those people who has emerged as a real specialist and someone that SARS has used in numerous, you know, high-profile controversial tax matters. Off the top of my head, you know, other than the Sean Mkhize matter, for which she was in Durban, long-standing battles with SARS, you know, in that case. But there's also some state capture matters that she has appeared for SARS on, including regiments and, you know, other things like that. So she's one of those people who, like Clutha Murray, the liquidator who was murdered last year together with his son, they sort of become preferred by SARS because they have this track record of just not being afraid, doing their job. You know, there's never any allegations of wrongdoing or anything like that. They get on with the job and they are very, very effective at it.
I do appreciate the reporting. Kyle Cowan from News 24, thank you very much indeed for joining me today. Perhaps just worth referencing part of a statement from SARS Commissioner Edward Kiswetter, who says, and I quote, "The shocking act is intended to intimidate officers of court to abandon the vital work they're performing in furtherance of our country's legal system."
You're listening to MoneyWeb at Midday.
Now, it was, to say the least, frightening, a sense of our real dependence on technology and what happens when it fails. A cybersecurity update from CrowdStrike malfunctioned Friday, and that, as you well know, caused a global tech outage. The fault, from what I can understand, was caused by a defect in a Falcon content update for Windows hosts. And Kosanati Ndlovu is a journalist with Tech Central and joins me on the program now. And firstly, then, can you provide a detailed account of what exactly happened on Friday? And do we have more clarity as the working week starts?
So, Jeremy, yes. What happened is that there was faulty code in a software update for the Falcon security software, which CrowdStrike is a vendor of. This is one of the most widely distributed soft cybersecurity packages in the world. And this led to massive outages affecting computers at thousands of large organizations, including banks, media houses, hospitals, and airports. We do know that the glitch affected Microsoft Azure services, Microsoft 365 services, as well as Windows systems. We know that Linux and macOS users were not impacted by this, but Microsoft did come out over the weekend and say that 8.5 or over 8.5 million devices were affected by the glitch.
So what is going to prevent this kind of thing from happening in the future?
Well, it seems as though the issue is actually internal at CrowdStrike, that they did release a software update that where there was a glitch in the code and it went through their procedures, their procedural checks. So for them to prevent this, obviously, they just need to be much more careful at how they deploy their software when they're doing it.
When you talk about a glitch in the code, when it comes to any kind of update like this, is this something fairly common or was this really out of the ordinary?
Well, this is somewhat out of the ordinary. The reason that this happened with CrowdStrike software is that the Falcon software is tightly interwoven with the kernel, which is the core of your operating system. Because of this tight integration, if anything wrong happens in the kernel, in the software itself, then your kernel itself is at risk, and this is what happened in this scenario. Now, you or I, when we use antivirus software, the antivirus is not actually sitting in the kernel, it's just an application. Mm. So if it happens that your vendor releases a patch or an update that is somewhat faulty, it might affect your system, but it won't cause it to crash in the way that this has, because it is not as closely interwoven with your kernel. So for organizations, I think maybe questions being asked are, do we want to use security or a security software system that works at this layer of the operating system? Do we want to perhaps mitigate that risk by using software that works at an application level? Of course, then there's a trade-off there because, you know, the closer to the operating system the security system is, the better it can fight off viruses because it has privileged access. So yeah, this is something that companies will have to think about going forward.
Do we have a better idea of how South Africa was impacted on Friday?
Well, the biggest report we did receive was from Capitec Bank. I think they came out on Friday morning at 7 already, saying that their customers didn't have access to the banking app, internet banking, card payments were not going through, etc. But I think that by 11 on the day, they had recovered most of their systems. And I haven't heard any reports of their systems being down over the weekend. It does seem that from a South African perspective, the impact of this was not as wide. I mean, if you look comparatively, if you look at Australia and in the US, airports were down, flights were grounded, and even some hospitals were dysfunctioning, whereas we didn't have those reports here at home. So I think we were rather sheltered from this one.
One of the key lessons I would imagine for any organization, and for that matter, cybersecurity firms, would be to think about using multiple vendors for their cybersecurity rather than having to engage in a single point of failure, as you've outlined for me now.
Mm. Yes, that's definitely one strategy, especially if your organization is very large, then you don't want to put, you might want to spread the risk and not put the entire organization at risk. Another way of doing this, especially for large organizations, is to tier updates. So for example, if an update for software comes out today, then say only your IT guys get the update today for the next week or two, and you just have that window so that if there are any glitches in that, then it's the experts who will be dealing with it and identifying it before then that update is then rolled over to the rest of the organization.
It's an astonishing story because it also reveals a lot about the global dependence on technology and the potential risks when critical tech services fail. And that is just something that we're going to have to get used to. You can't walk away from this now, but you've got to understand with a greater degree of intensity, I imagine, the risk that something like this provides.
Yes, I think organizations are no longer used to thinking manually. You know, everyone is going digital, and I think this just shows has showed many organizations how weak they can be when something like this happens. And so I think when building systems, when building businesses, people do need to think about these kinds of events, what to do when they happen, and what kind of backups, and then teach people within the organizations how, as you teach people in a fire drill, you know, if there's a fire, these are the exits, and this is what you do. Well, if our systems are down, and you know, we cannot access our computers, how will we keep the business going?
And to that end, it's not fixed just yet. It's still going to take a huge amount of work to get computers back up and running. This is going to take a couple of days, if not weeks.
Yes, it is taking some time. I think that some organizations seem to be out of the woods. I have been following Microsoft 365 on Twitter, and they seem to be showing some good progress. CloudStrike on their website as well are giving updates, you know, almost every few hours to say how they are going with the problem. But it seems as though the worst has passed, but then there is still a recovery that especially the larger organizations have to go through, which will also involve manually inputting data that went that did not go through the system while there was an outage, and that is going to take them some time.
Nothing more terrifying than that blue screen of death. And Nkosinathi and Ndlovu, thank you very much indeed. Journalist at Tech Central. Appreciate your time.
MoneyWeb at midday for all your up-to-date stories.
Now, 4 months before the American election, and the process has been completely upended with a decision by Joe Biden. He's 81 years old, who's ended his presidential re-election campaign. The consensus is that it was a selfless decision that put the country's interests and the party's interests before his own. Commentator and international relations expert Professor John Stremlaw is with me on the program now. And John, firstly then, what are your thoughts on this decision and the impact it's going to have on the November election?
Well, my thoughts are it's about time. You know, no man is above the law, as Nelson Mandela famously said, and he stressed the importance of institutions and due process. And Biden had said that the democracy would be on the ballot in 2024 in the United States. It was on the ballot here in South Africa, and he's risen to the occasion and stepped aside. And I applaud him for doing so, and in such a gracious manner. In the letter that he wrote on yesterday, it was released at 1:45 p.m. in Washington, and it was terrific. And I hope that Kamala Harris will consolidate. She's 60 years old, and win in November, because Donald Trump has got to be stopped.
Professor Stremlaw, with one signature, the entire landscape of the United States election has been changed. How do you think things are going to play out now in the 4 months left to the election?
Well, it's very hard to predict, Jeremy, but let's stand back for a second and just bear in mind that, yes, a signature was signed. Individuals do matter at the highest levels. But the institutions and the processes matter, and the rules and the guardrails. And Trump is disdaining of all those. He's an authoritarian in the making. And I think and he also is honest in saying that the Republicans will never win a popular election, which is the way we operate a democracy here. And in the U.S., it's prisoner of its states' rights electoral college, and so there will be a contest in the key swing states that was anticipated by Biden and Trump. And Trump is leading in those at the moment, but Kamala Harris is just getting started, and she's going to take him to the cleaners.
Professor, let me ask you about Kamala Harris, if I can. Is she guaranteed a place at the top of the ticket, or could she still be challenged in an open convention in Chicago?
She could be challenged, and Joe Manchin was talking about doing so at one point. But it's unprecedented, this conflated process. And so the pledge delegates are likely to be going to Kamala Harris, but she's got to be very careful in how she organizes the vice presidential debate and clearance process. She just can't, I don't think, do what Donald Trump did with J.D. Vance, the 39-year-old know-nothing who's coming to with him on the ticket. So that she's got to legitimate herself, and that's a challenge, but she seems to understand that. And she does have access to the $96 million that Biden has in the bank because she's a member of the ticket. And I think that the opposition to her will melt away within the Democratic Party, but whether she can beat Donald Trump is an issue that only the voters can settle on November 5th.
Professor, there is some talk in the United States today that Joe Biden should step down immediately, essentially saying that if he doesn't believe he can win the election, is he fit to run the country?
No, that's not the case. He is fit, and he's got advisors, and I would worry greatly. And I, you know, I'm 80, and so I'm not the same guy that I used to be, that he could not survive 4 years. But also, age would be a matter for Trump. Now, the age is a matter for Trump again, but with Kamala Harris arguing at 60 that she's much better able to serve out her term than the McDonald's hamburger-chomping, non-exercising Donald Trump.
John Strimlaw, are there key issues now that Kamala Harris would need to address to differentiate herself from Trump and gain voter support? And I would imagine key among those would be perhaps a reigniting of the abortion debate.
Of course. And she's been very good on that. And women are likely to rally to her cause because she is very good on abortion, but she's also very good on a whole variety of progressive issues that matter to young people and to women and to minorities who are becoming rapidly a majority in the United States. That's why the Make America Great crowd of white Christian males is fighting the last stand, in my view. It's going to look very, very different going forward demographically. And so they're the white minority racist group is leading the charge on disenfranchising voters and gerrymandering districts and doing all sorts of things to try to stay in power as a minority government, reminiscent of the old apartheid regime that gave up.
John, Joe Biden's withdrawal now and effectively the nomination or the impending nomination of Kamala Harris, how then is it going to affect the Republican strategy moving forward? Does Donald Trump continue to do more of the same, or does he have to have a different approach, do you think?
Well, he is a Johnny One Note, as he showed in his acceptance speech, where he rambled on and on about the things that he has grievances. So I don't know whether he'll change very much, but the Republican Party is getting geared up for Kamala Harris, and the word is now, oh, she's a lot easier to beat than Joe Biden. Well, they weren't saying that a while back, so we'll see. But they are a minority party, and the question will become how they operate in the battleground states under the peculiar U.S. electoral system, which is nothing that South Africa should look to.
Professor John Strimlaw, thank you very much indeed.
You're listening to MoneyWeb at Midday.
And finally on the program, let's bring it back to local politics. And the South African Local Government Association is urging the new 7th Parliament to prioritize the local government agenda and use its legislative and oversight powers to emphasize what it terms revitalizing dysfunctional municipalities and improving service delivery. So what's the big plan here? More now from Chief of Operations, Lance Joel, who joins me on the program. And firstly, Mr. Joel, do you think that local government is simply being ignored by national government?
Well, Jeremy, if you do a comparative analysis of all of the president's State of the Nation addresses and now the recent opening of Parliament address, you would for the first time see a real focus on local government and a real attempt to want to address the weaknesses in local government. So certainly there's been an about turn from the previous years to last week's address. And so it would, to some extent, confirm your statement that perhaps local government has been neglected in the past. And based on the outcomes of the recent national and provincial elections, there is now realization that there must be a focus on local government. And for us, there is a positive development.
It's an about turn, but also driven by absolute necessity. And in many cases, when it comes to smaller municipalities, by sheer desperation.
Yes, I mean, while we can't wish away the fact that there has been good progress made by municipalities, but certainly there have been more challenges that has been standing in the way of municipalities and local government collectively meeting their constitutional mandate. And certainly what is now becoming clear, Jeremy, is that there is an acknowledgement that municipalities are different in form and shape. Some are urbanized, some are rural. And you heard that the focus is now on those outlying rural municipalities to also get them onto the grid to develop their local economies as well, and moving a bit away from the focus on your urbanized metropolitan areas. So indeed, encouraging moments, but I hope it is not talk, and we're hoping that we're going to see this coming through in practice.
It's also about getting the right people in place and dealing with corruption, issues that have not been dealt sufficiently with in the past.
Yes, we agree with that, Jeremy. We have been at the forefront, shouting on the top of our voices for consequence management and accountability. We have certainly seen that at a local government level, that has not received the necessary attention. There has been quite a bit of wrongdoing. If you look at the Auditor General's reports for the past three financial years, there's always been an emphasis on corruption and the lack of consequence management and accountability. So that has also come through quite strongly from the president's report, but it also emerged in the SONA of last year, and we have seen very little in that regard. We are hoping that we will certainly see more in the coming months.
You have a platform. This is the South African Local Government Association. How then are you going to up your game and become better at accountability?
Well, we believe, Jeremy, that it requires us to engage in a very structured manner with the relevant role players. And we have taken a decision that not only are we going to interact with the recently elected executives, meaning starting at the top, we're going to interact with the president, we're going to interact with all of the premiers, we're going to interact with all of the local government relevant ministries, but also we want to interact with political parties. We believe that political parties must play a more proactive role in managing the councillors that they have deployed to local government. We believe strongly that there is a much bigger role to be played by political parties. We have not seen that in the past. Political parties must hold the councillors they have deployed accountable for what happens and what does not happen. So our structured approach of engagement will certainly want to respond to elevating the issue of accountability and consequence management, but ensuring that those in the executive positions, but more importantly, those in political parties, are part of the conversations and are acting accordingly.
Why do you think political parties have been loath to do this in the past?
I don't think political management has been an emphasis. There has more been an emphasis on dealing with national issues and dealing with provincial issues, but there's not as much focus on local issues, and in particular on councillors themselves. That may have been a development that we have seen as a link to the past, but I think now that there's recognition that the potential weakest link in the chain is local government, and much more needs to be done to ensure that local government works and everyone works together to make local government work. So I think there is a change of emphasis, and we would want to use this as an opportunity to call for more consequence management and accountability.
I am going to leave it there. Thank you very much for joining me today from the South African Local Government Association Chief of Operations, Lance Joel. I appreciate your time. Thank you. And just before we close the program today, on our online poll and ahead of an interview tomorrow with the new Home Affairs Minister, Leon Schreiber, my question to you around new efforts at dealing with the massive visa backlog. Government has pronounced on it, so do you think it is sufficient? Are you adopting a wait-and-see attitude, or do you think the entire system, both IT and simply queuing, is simply too compromised? If you have a view on that, you can participate in the poll on our X or LinkedIn pages. On our last poll, almost half of our respondents told me they were worried about the quality of the drinking water, particularly here in Johannesburg. And that is our program for today. MoneyWeb at Midday is live at noon weekdays. We are then up as a podcast. Goodbye to you, and thank you for listening.
Listen to the daily live stream of MoneyWeb at midday or download episodes on moneyweb.co.za, the MoneyWeb app, Apple Podcasts and Spotify, or follow MoneyWeb News on social media for more updates. MoneyWeb, your trusted source for business and investment insights.